RMN Behaving Badly, a topical, political and satirical podcast about, well, it's supposed to be about mental health nursing in the UK, but really it's about saying how awful the Tories are and how everything is Thatcher's fault. My name's Ed Freshwater and I'm joined as ever by Scotland's greatest achievement, advocate-in-chief, troublemaker in perpetuity, all-round good communicator and the true people's president, Stuart Mackenzie. Welcome to the show. Stuart, how are you, mate?
I'm certainly not going to live up to that, brother. I like the fact that you've just got straight to the end of the show in the introduction by saying why we're here. No need for a conversation.
You know, we're 2 years into this and 3 years?
Three years.
God.
Remember, we kicked off the same year as the International Year of the Nurse.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And remember, we don't use the phrase kicking off. We use, yeah. Anyway, moving on.
I didn't know I was in clinical supervision there.
Yeah. Let's just flag this one for the NMC.
Appropriately, as in kicking off the kicking off a football match.
Oh, right, kicking off football match. Okay.
I don't know what you were referring to.
So anyway, last time we did a show, moving swiftly on, we had a new prime minister.
If you did.
we had our hiatus because life happens and bloody hell. And we came back to do a special episode purely because Liz Truss was prime minister. And oh my God, her raft of interesting choices. And we did one episode and then she was gone. So I think we should probably chalk that up as a win for us.
I'm going to take it as a win.
I'm going to take that credit. I think we should. Yeah.
And I think anyone who has any qualitative or quantifiable information that can suggest otherwise should send it in to us.
I mean, I like to think that the majority of Conservative MPs do listen to this show and make a lot of decisions. Oh, no, hang on.
You've got the Tory party confused with a completely different organisation.
Yes, I have. That's what I've done there.
I mean, it's easy to see how that could happen.
It is easy to see. I mean, yes, actually, I can't imagine any Conservative would be sitting listening to this.
Rishi Sunak's aides obviously listen. The litmus test for the nation is our podcast.
If the litmus test for the nation is our podcast, then I think it's fair to say that our nation is well and truly screwed.
I don't think so, Ed.
I really
don't think so. I think we need to occupy the same egocentric, narcissistic space as some of them and just make lots of assumptions about what's good for people. And if you predicate that on our mental health nursing background, then I think our assumptions would be far safer than their assumptions.
I think the problem that you and I would ever have in sort of meeting the level that Conservative MPs are at is that we've actually trained at something and are competent at it. So I don't think it would matter how much confidence or arrogance we took into the place, because we would still have actual, you know, skills that were useful in the real world.
Here's a question.
I would, not so much you.
If there was a regulator of MPs, how busy do you think they'd be?
I think they would probably be off sick and referred to my team fairly quickly.
Do you think that they might find themselves subject to procedure?
What are we talking about? Are we talking about if there was an NMC equivalent for members of parliament?
If you get elected,
you have to sign up to the register. You've got to revalidate. You've got to adhere by a code of conduct.
So apply that logic of revalidation. Mm-hmm. So before every general election or every election that you stand in, you have to be able to demonstrate that you have attained knowledge, you have ensured that you're competent, that you've learned some stuff, you've maybe expanded your horizons. You know, if your portfolio includes economics and you use the calculator in your iPhone, you might have went, and, I mean, I'm not being flippant, we need to continue in professional development, right? And that can't be just being shifted around the cabinet. That doesn't count as continuous professional development, right?
Well, but this morning I was Minister of Transport, but this afternoon I'm now Health Secretary, and then tomorrow I'll be Foreign Minister, and then after that I'll be on the back benches. But then I think probably by tomorrow tea time I'll either be Chancellor or, you know, Going home.
So to which home? Which home? So this is the thing for me. If you were to apply the level of scrutiny and rigor, rightly so, which a registrant of the NMC should have, I absolutely agree that this is backing the position that as people who, to protect the public, we require that regulation, we require that objective, if you like, supervision and monitoring, yeah, of practice and performance and
evidence of training in the role.
How that's driven through the deanery and how that relates to what education for pre-reg should look like, post-reg, specialist practice. If you then apply that to the people who run our lives, it's startling the what you don't have to demonstrate your ability. If you look at what a new registrant, a newly qualified nurse has to demonstrate to enter the register, right?
Or you're an hour and 45 minutes short on that placement.
Serious.
I know. I'm just thinking of before you get elected, you need to have done a certain number of hours in community service or something like that. Yeah.
You need to have done a theory test before you can sit in a car and drive it. The foreign minister gets to tell the army where to go.
Yeah. Meanwhile, we're not allowed to secondary dispense.
Have you done your unsupervised practice with medication?
Do you know? But thinking about
you haven't completed the harness for this person, so we're referring you for fitness to practice.
You'd failed to record if the patient had access to a public swimming pool or a I couldn't because the Tories have shut them all down. Everybody's whole notes is the same.
You didn't record that in the notes though, so I'm afraid we're going to have to realistically, a parliamentary regulator would be saying, look here, Mr. Williamson, most of your paperwork is up to date, but according to our records, you haven't told anybody to slit their throat this year. So if you do that, then we can pass your revalidation, but not until you've told a civil servant to kill themselves.
Which, just for clarity, according to other media sources and outlets, was what was recorded, just giving you some...
Mm-hmm.
Right. But what I would say is this, the Right Honourable Member for Chidwick, we see that you failed to record that income that seemed to appear in your bank account from, what was that, one of the party donors? Well, we'll let you off with not recording that this year.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I know it appears we're making light, but it's such an unlevel playing field.
This is the part that is satire.
But it is such an unplaying level field when you look at what doctors, nurses, allied health professionals, psychologists, pharmacists, right? We all pay to be on a register, right? And we all
pay to be on a professional register. A
professional register.
There we go.
Right. The forensic nurse in me is like, I mean, I would have given you the full detail, but you know, I can walk down the street. Right, without a tag. But the reality of the matter is, how can we have, so the four pillars, thinking about the four pillars for the NMC, perhaps part of the reason that we see such a shift in the very fluid, kind of values on display in British politics is because nobody's actually sat them down and went, can he do that stuff? It's just, you know, people are, it's not a done thing. Yeah. Civil servants have feelings, you know. The general population elect you. But there seems to be this impervious kind of suit of well, yes, we're here, we're elected, we better crack on.
Has anybody told Sir Gavin that the plebs are actually human beings as well?
You know,
they can't be both, for God's sake. Choose one. Yeah,
it's binary choice, isn't it? And
yeah,
you know, be rich or be poor,
mm-hmm.
be well or be unwell.
Well, yes. Oh, I've already had an argument with somebody this week about whether or not
You've not had an argument. You don't argue.
Me, I know. It's quite a stretch, but yeah, just that whole alcohol abuse, drug abuse is a choice. It's there. It's all down to choices that people make. Anyway, moving swiftly on.
Like the choice is it's people choose to live in poverty.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I brought it up. And this is all in the context of. I don't know if you've noticed, but suddenly people are starting to talk about this idea of charging for GP appointments again. And
I haven't heard about this.
Yeah, it's happening on certain levels and in a couple of places. And there was a, I think it was in Pulse magazine today, one of the doctors' magazines, and an opinion piece from a GP. Talking about the over-medicalization of things and then just casually dropping in that perhaps there are some things that we should charge people to have treated, and that would keep waiting lists down, that would keep queues down, that would mean we could see the more important cases and all of that. But in setting up this context of, look, the NHS is in a terrible state right now and we do need to do something drastic, I'm starting to see more and more voices now say, perhaps it's about time we started charging for GP appointments. And of course, every time that's been looked into, it's always been shown that it would cost an awful lot more to administer than it would raise. Mm-hmm. But it would also prevent people who didn't have 10 quid for a GP appointment from going to the GP. So they would just wait until they were really sick and go to A&E. There was a GP on Newsnight last week, I think, and he was suggesting the idea that that you should be charged for going to your to GP, and he actually referred to it as a disincentive, and we need to have a disincentive to stop people going to their GP so often. And and the interviewer, I think it was Faisal Islam, asking him, you know, if isn't it already a disincentive for people with the hours that you have to spend on hold, that you have to queue outside the place, that it takes you weeks to get an appointment with your GP? Isn't that already a disincentive? And this GP, just like with absolutely no insight whatsoever, starts going on about, yes, and that's why we're seeing A&E so completely overloaded. And just going, and what do you think will happen if you start charging people for going to their GP? Do you think more are going to go to A&E, or do you think fewer? But it just seems one of those...
General practice is the fundamental component mm-hmm. of the NHS. Mm-hmm. Free at the point of delivery. More people are seen in general practice. Hospital care is not the first choice or first, should never be the first route of entry into service.
No.
In fact, if we're thinking about a public health approach and a health promotion approach, then general practice, and I think, you know, and I have to say, you know, I never saw that episode, but I would imagine that gentleman doesn't speak for general practitioners across the United Kingdom. I can think of some incredibly hardworking general practitioners who are working at their absolute bottoms off mm. to continue to provide a patient-centred service. I can imagine they're the types of GPs who would shudder at the thought of patients being charged £10 to come and see them. How does a person in the early stages of dementia, you know, navigate that system?
Absolutely.
How does a distressed mother of a child, for someone who has come, I mean, a new Scot, for example, who's just come to settle in Scotland, who has mm-hmm. language barrier issues and communication issues, how do you even think to implement that?
Yeah.
How does that transaction take place with the receptionist?
Yeah.
You know,
because you know they've got so much time on their hands.
Just tap the machine, but this goes to the heart of the stuff that, you know.
Well, tap the machine, assuming you have a contactless card,
assuming you have a bank account, assuming you have money. I mean, where do homeless people sit in that? You know,
that's the thing that, but that leads back to this overwhelming attitude within. that level of, you know, people that are in that level of income, people that are of that, I hate to use the word elite, but, you know, people that are in government and believe that, people that are in senior leadership positions and believe that being poor is a choice, they just don't have this connection at all of understanding that some people don't have bank accounts.
I agree and, the concept that some people
and that some people don't have smartphones and some people don't have unlimited Wi-Fi. Data on their phones to be able to book online appointments. Mm-hmm. Sometimes somebody might have the choice of, I can either have a WhatsApp consultation with my GP or I can speak to my family this month.
Let's remember how much of mainland UK and it is rural. Mm-hmm. There are areas in the United Kingdom where, you know, the concept of fibre optic, you may as well drive one of the Jetsons rocket cars up the street.
Yeah.
Because the reality of the matter is that accessing healthcare is not an equal playing field. And that's not always predicated in people's choices. Mm-hmm. You know, that's...
In fact, most of the time it isn't.
You know, that's not predicated on accessing health. In the main, my experience working in health boards, whether in remote and rural communities, they're very resilient. These communities, they're very used to being able to adapt to need and work with what's there, and almost a recognition that, yeah, there is a buy-off, there is a trade-off, but that doesn't mean to say that the quality of their care shouldn't be the same, and that they shouldn't have alternatives to accessibility, and that the modes of that accessibility, you know, so if you do have remote and rural and island communities, do you prioritise them for free access and free Wi-Fi to make sure that they can engage with services? Because recognising that if you're on the mainland, you can get a bus or there are other ways.
Yeah.
We ran a project recently for young people, and we paid for the transport because we wanted to ensure engagement, because the value of the engagement and the experience for them over a project, mm-hmm. for a 12-week period was critical, and the staff within my teams recognised that, and we budgeted for that. Well, they budgeted for that. It was their project and they ran with it with these kids, but they got 100% engagement over 12 weeks on Saturdays.
Incredible.
On Saturdays.
That's an astonishing level of engagement.
And what we did was we paid for a taxi to go and get them and bring them to the project. But they built into that project that actually coming by transport was part of the therapeutic engagement, because these were children and young people who had anxiety and and things. I don't want to get into too much detail, but you know, the team have developed posters. But I use that narrative because when you think about remote and rural, it's not always in the outer Hebrides, or, you know, there are remote and rural communities on the mainland, you know, and I think it's really important to think about you know, some of the projects that I read taking place in Highlands and Islands about engagement, you know, and some of the remote and remote, incredibly innovative work to make sure that people are helped to engage so that you maximise the outcomes for them, positive outcomes for them, by doing as much as you can to enable them to be there. And that's the trade-off, you know, you front load that, you invest in that, knowing that what you're then doing is giving them the tools for recovery. And I think I do, you know, the innovation that I see take place in the practice across the services that I'm aware of and familiar with and that I read about. But then that's really hard. How do you evolve that? I mean, we're sitting here looking at that article in The Independent a couple of weeks ago, the Royal College of Psychiatry's open letter to Jeremy Hunt ahead of the August budget announcement.
Mini budget, whatever,
It's the mini budget and the autumn budget.
Or the let's just try and ignore what Quasi and Liz did a couple of weeks ago.
So, you know, you've got the Royal College of Psychiatry basically saying, yeah, we appreciate things are difficult, but taking money out of mental health service provision is actually going to cost us more money in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but what you're doing is you're reducing accessibility, you're reducing treatment pathways, you're rather than maximising the potential for people to engage in addiction services or to engage in healthy lifestyle choices or harm reduction at that primary care, secondary care level through GP practices, you're waiting till people are so unwell that then they need to end up in tertiary, tier two, tier three services where people are in beds or people are subjected to legislation. It's almost like, well, do you know, investing in mental health, you know, it was almost like it was last year's thing. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really quite harsh to think of it like that, but we need to be mindful of looking at that through the prism of the potential industrial action by health sector and public sector workers, because it wouldn't just be Jeremy Hunt who could be considered anti-trade union or anti-public sector worker when you start to hear things being bandied around like, well, it's a record-breaking pay deal and, well, you know, we've had to cut other areas of the budget to make sure we can pay the nurses. No, that's not how this works.
Mm-hmm.
There are other things that could be cut. You don't have to directly cut health and social care to pay the people who work in it, because actually what you're doing is saying, well, there's some money, but by the way, see the queues you're managing and those waiting lists you're managing and the number of people at the front door, that's going to be even heavier on you. So that's, there you are.
Yeah.
Have your pay rise, but this is what you get. But I mean,
that really is the very insidious thing about it.
It's nasty. It's nasty.
Yeah, because what they're doing is we're going, oh, fine, you can have your pay rise, but you tell us which life support system you're going to switch off mm-hmm. to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And that is essentially, you know, without being hyperbolic about it, that is the choice that they're giving to providers is and to the NHS as a whole, is to say, all right, but you're going to have to come up with, you know, we've cut things and we've made it more difficult. And it's not just the NHS budget itself, it's the cuts to all the other things that have increased the burden on the NHS. And then they're saying, well, if you want people to be paid at the same level as they were in 2010, which is all that anybody's asking for, is to be paid at the same level as we were getting paid in 2010. Just account for inflation and bring it up to what it was.
We're so far behind. Yeah. We're so far behind our economy's recovery. And again, I don't, you know, I'm no fiscal expert. You know, my wife will tell you that.
I should have put that in your intro.
Our economy has growth post-COVID is outstripped by Germany, France, and the USA.
Yeah.
Right. There are active challenges. And we had these conversations, Ed, when we spoke about the word austerity. That was an active strategy by a political party mm-hmm. to create an economic environment where they could manipulate expenditure in the public sector. And at the same time as austerity, they pushed the benefits system to collapse.
Yeah.
Right? And lives were lost.
By extension of that, yeah, the people who were reliant on the benefit system were pushed to collapse and in many cases beyond it. Yeah.
Yeah. And we've got the Marmot review, the 10-year review. It talks mm-hmm. about that. It talks about the lack of accessibility and benefits. It talks about the lack of infrastructure to support benefits and housing and the knock-on impact of people and health outcomes. Mm-hmm. It talks about how health in terms of growth of need versus growth of investment. So, you know, the economic argument is there. The detail is there. And that's, you know, we keep going into these budgets and I keep feeling like I just want to throw the Marmot review at these people and go, have you read this?
Yeah.
Have you actually read this?
I mean, the thing that I really want to see is somebody taking them to task of it with a copy of Marmot's review in their hand and saying,
look,
what about these deaths of despair? What about these increasing health inequalities? What about the fact that every time you cut a budget, every single penny you cut somewhere has an overwhelmingly negative impact on the most vulnerable people? Why is it that you can't, with all of your alleged brilliance, why is it that you can't come up with some sort of spending solution that protects the most vulnerable, the highest risk, the people who are least able to absorb sudden changes?
But we talk about these difficult decisions that need to be made.
But actually, they're not difficult decisions.
They're not
at all.
They're really easy decisions.
It is a let's kick the weakest person. It's not a difficult decision. It's
No, but I'm gonna call it out.
I'm just gonna call it out straight away, and I'm gonna say it's bullying. I'm gonna say genuinely, I believe they're failing in their duty to protect the British public. But they know fine well they'll get away with it because they're pals in the papers and they've spent so long doing this. If you're on benefits, you're a cheat and a skiver and work shy and you don't deserve it. If you're poor, you deserve to be poor. That's the narrative they have been pushing for fucking decades. Apologies for the swear word there, but that's the narrative they push. And then they justify cuts to everything because, you know, these people are basically scum and deserve to be where they are. So we should punish them by making their lives unbearable. And they do it about people with disabilities. They do it about people with severe mental illness. They do it about people with chronic physical health problems. They do it about people who are fleeing war, you know, refugees and asylum seekers, people who are fleeing persecution. They treat them as if they deserve to be not just unhappy, not just poor, but that they should suffer for who they are.
But this is the so taking your point.
Find a fence and sit on it. That's my philosophy.
Taking your point. let's strip that back to about competency, about professionalism, about conduct, about values. All of the things that we as nurses, that public protection, that confidence and inspired public, right? You take that back to that, you know, those cornerstones, those pillars of what we do as registered nurses. If you have no tangible experience of the people about whom you're subjecting to that policy, why would they? I mean, this is, I'm being serious here. If you have no experiential learning, you know, and I don't mean just putting on a high-vis vest and a life jacket and going out in a boat and seeing some people try to flee across. I don't mean that. I mean, actually served someone a meal, given someone a blanket, and sat with someone as their child in distress and helped them.
And not done it for the benefit of the photographer.
Right, and actually done these things and spent time trying to understand the stories and get underneath the kind of hyperbole that's projected by media outlets based upon who they want to see in power. That's where we are as nurses. I mean, we've had this conversation about all nurses being, you know, nursing is political. Nursing's absolutely political because the majority of our patients, I mean, I listened to a Radio Scotland article this morning on the radio about the length of time it's taken to determine COPD and the negative outcomes that has on people's expected life outcomes. And we know COPD is associated with smoking, but we also know it's associated with work environments and the types of environments that people have spent their careers in or been subjected to. But that's really judgmental. It doesn't matter what the person has done to contract the illness or how that's affected them. The fact is they have it. Judgment isn't going to make them feel any better.
Of course, if it is contracted through the work environment, it's not like, well, you know, you chose to work in the mills. you chose to be sent up chimneys when you were a kid.
But so we know that we know from asbestosis in the shipyards. We know from asbestosis, and we still have people living with that today, and families suffering with that. And the point around that was, I take your point, you know, about there being a cognizant decision to follow a pathway of policies which have negative outcomes for people. But I really do feel the disconnect between UK politics and the people who those decisions. I think there's such a chasm now of reality, of unreality. I don't think there is really this tangible, you know, this idea that MPs are in surgeries and people are engaged. I really genuinely don't think there's a connection anymore. I think that there are just people making policies. It's all about money. It's not about quality. It's not about life, because there are some hard decisions to be made if you're them. They're hard decisions for them because they've got hard decisions like, should we have a nuclear deterrent or should we not? I don't see it as, should we have a nuclear deterrent or should we not? Should we have a nuclear deterrent or should we invest all that money in the NHS and education? Right, that's the choice for me.
Yeah.
It's
or,
not...
or should we spend untold billions on a new nuclear power station that probably isn't going to work, is going to go six times over budget, won't start producing any energy for 20 years? Or should we be investing in tidal that's going to have that's going to be
generational
online?
Generational benefits.
Yeah, and will be online by next summer. You know.
But these are what it's portrayed to the public is, well, we had to make this choice. If we don't have a nuclear, it's either have a nuclear deterrent or we're a
or Putin would be here now.
And I'm a bit like,
what the hell would Putin want with this?
Do you know? I mean,
he already owns it.
So. You know, well, him and his oligarchs. Mm-hmm. So, and I think this is the thing for me. I try when I listen to the news to think, okay, what I've just heard is it's this or this. Is it really? Yeah, we can, you know, we just ordered five new, I heard today there was the Ministry of Defence have ordered five naval frigates. Yeah, right. So I'm sitting here in Glasgow. That usually means that jobs will be protected in the naval dockyards and recycling in Glasgow. And that's great. Of course, that's great. But the difficult decision there wasn't about those people's jobs or those livelihoods. It was about making sure that the deterrent of having a navy was there. So don't dress it up as that you're keeping people in jobs, you know, because you don't care about the people in the shipyards.
What they care about is being seen to be, you know, strong on defence.
Yeah. And
because
so
it's a vote winner with the... Yeah.
With certain people. And I think to get back to where we, at the baseline for us, is weird.
God, know, what were we talking about?
Well, I don't know. In terms of mental health, but when you drill it back, you look at how these policies have negative consequences for the outcomes of individuals. Mm-hmm. They're part of the reason why nurses could potentially take industrial action. This wasn't just about pay. That Unison, GMB, Unite, the Royal College of Nursing were very, very, very clear when they balloted their members that this was not just about pay. It was about a lack of investment in infrastructure. It was about poor working conditions. It was about the lack of investment in the workforce. It was about the lack of clarity around how people were going to your pensions, for example, in the NHS. How many changes mm-hmm. have we had in our public sector pensions? This is consistent. It undermines recruitment. It undermines people's thoughts about, actually, do I want to work here anymore?
Yeah.
Retention. And you end up in a situation where, regardless of your band, because it's all relevant, whether you're a senior charge nurse, whether you're a staff nurse or a manager, you're still entitled to be fiscally rewarded for the job that you do.
Yeah.
And that's usually predicated in your expertise, your training, your education, your years of service. But what we've got now is those people with all those years of service are the ones that aren't actually getting any credit and aren't being valued.
Yeah.
So we're chewing up the ones.
Well, that's because they're all, you know, they're all managers now on £150,000.
Did you see how the BBC projected those figures?
Oh,
you know,
without putting any context of this is what has happened with inflation, by the way.
Absolutely went for band sevens. Absolutely mm-hmm. went for band sevens to make it look like somehow these individuals, but then with no narrative as to what it takes to actually do that job.
And the level of responsibility and the level of training and the level of, yeah.
And the impact that accountability has in your own life.
Yeah.
You know, we don't talk about that. We don't talk about, I mean, let's go back to resilience, Ed, conversations of a bygone time.
Oh, God, yeah, our favourite phrase.
And I think, you know, we kind of have wobbled around subject matters here, but in terms of accountability,
it's hardly a record for us, is it?
Maybe we're asking for people to be accountable who don't actually understand what it is they're accountable for.
Well, that's a very big part of it. I mean, people do make decisions. I remember, you know, back when I lived up in the islands, before I became a grown up, up in Shetland,
and they gave you a passport.
I know, you're 18 now, bugger off.
Get off this island.
Yeah, away to Glasgow and find out what chips are supposed to taste like. But historically, you know, up in Orkney, up in Shetland, and it's similar for the Western Isles and lots of rural communities. These are places where people are reliant on their own car to be able to get around. But Shetland has long had one of the highest per litre costs of petrol of anywhere in the UK. Petitions were signed and, you know, representations made to the members of parliament and councillors and all of that, saying we're paying way more. You know, if we lived in a city, we would be paying, in some cases, 20 pence a litre less than we do living out in this rural community. Will you please take a petition to parliament? And it's happened more than once, but petitions went to parliament, and whichever civil servant or minister or junior minister was tasked with looking into it would go, we can't possibly give you a fuel subsidy, because people would then travel there specifically to buy cheaper petrol. It's like, do you know how much it costs to put your car on the damn ferry in Aberdeen, sit on that ferry for 14 hours to get up to Shetland, fill your car up, save maybe £3.50, then put your car back on the ferry? You know, you would be £240 out of pocket to save £3 on petrol. But that was their decision. They were like, no, we can't do a subsidy, because then people will travel to get subsidized petrol with no concept of context, no concept of where this was occurring, and absolutely no interest in finding out. So they gave a response saying no, because people will travel to get cheap petrol. When you come back to them and say that's completely risible, you are clearly off your chump, they wouldn't entertain. Like, they were just like, we've given a response. And that's where these people are at. That's how that's disconnected they are. There's no accountability.
That's the level of, that's the level you're at. And I mean, how many years did we hear about London waiting?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you and I both lived in Aberdeen. Aberdeen cost a living at times in the early, late 90s, early 2000s was the same as London.
Yeah.
Property prices, fuel prices. You were in a situation where it was all equitable with London, but there was mm-hmm. no subsidies. And it's an artificial economy, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's an artificial economy designed to ensure that certain people can get away with charging higher rates, higher rents.
Artificially inflating house prices.
So what you do is you create these environments where it becomes acceptable, so people start getting a subsidised or an additionality into their wage, when in mm-hmm. actual fact, you should just pay people a decent wage. You're getting London waiting for that. I don't understand. I think if you live in a rural community where you do have to rely on because, like, you can't rely on public transport, let's face it. And that's not down to rail workers going on strike. That's down to, you know, successive governments of all parties completely disinvesting in the infrastructure. Yeah.
And functionally, in a rural community, it is cheaper to operate a car from house A to job B than it is to put on a bus service. Not least for the fuel cost of it, because it's cheaper to, you know, it uses less fuel to drive a car for that one person from A to B than it would to drive a bus. Yeah.
It doesn't. But again, you're applying logic where no logic exists.
Yeah.
And if you try being it, I mean, I remember having a conversation with someone about homelessness in rural communities.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, sorry. I'm like, yeah, it's, you know, there's real rural homelessness is a real issue.
What are you talking about? Everybody's got their own cow and they all live in a beautiful thatched farm.
And I was like, I don't understand why this is an issue for you, because obviously we have high instances of drug dependency and alcohol, you know, and looking at the lack of investment in infrastructure and the lack of...
In the countryside, right? But it's so tranquil. Why would anybody drink?
And I won't go into who it was with. Because,
Go on.
But you know,
I'm just going to guess. I'm going to say it was John Swinney.
No, it wasn't.
It was.
You can keep saying. I'm not going to say it. but the point was, they genuinely. And I'm
Archbishop of Canterbury.
It was actually quite neat. By the individual was like, I totally see that. No one's ever described that to me, how the lack of housing, the lack of opportunity, means that young people often move between family members and friends. They have no fixed abode of their own, or they'll have an address where mail goes to, which is usually the family address. But when things break down within the family unit, it's either too expensive for them to get a property, or problems that a lot of communities face in rural Scotland are that lots of houses will be Airbnbs. Mm-hmm. So access to affordable accommodation, which would naturally be available to them, is no longer there. Or if you're living in some of the universities town, and I'm sure it's the same in England,
yeah,
that absolutely pushes up the cost of living, which means that local people, local youth who are not going to university and who are looking to get that, they don't have the same accessibility to it. So, and then saying to someone, homelessness isn't just about sleeping on a street. You know, homelessness is about being deprived of the opportunity to have your own home that you can shut the door and feel safe in.
Yeah.
That you have access and egress to as and when you wish, that it's not dictated to you by another person or governed by another person. And homelessness comes in many forms. It's not that stereotypical. It, when we see that, you know, and Shelter do a really good job to go to lengths to talk about this. You know, it's not that media image of the person sitting at the side of the road with a cardboard box and covered newspaper. That's not the reality of homelessness for all homeless people. But again, like last year's news, we don't want to talk about that just now. You know, as people are talking about record high house prices at the same time as we're talking about a 2.5 year recession. Who's making money in there? How is people's mental health at the moment sitting looking at their mortgage going, literally, we've squeezed the last, and yet let's cut mental health, you know? And they talk about difficult decisions. I don't think if they realise the human factor. I think we deal with things in decimals and pounds and percentages. We don't deal with human life. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the way we record health narrative and health data removes the person. I feel that's my personal opinion. It removes the person. The number of people who have had a hip replacement doesn't speak to the quality of that experience. And it doesn't speak to the recovery of those individuals. And likewise in mental health, we record the negative outcomes. We don't, you know, clinicians don't, but we measure them and we report them. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't speak to the quality or the dedication of staff, or if the experience wasn't good by families or people, how did we use that to make the experience a positive one? We don't capture the qualitative stuff. All we capture is percentages. Mm-hmm. And that is so reductive. I feel it's reductive. I understand it's important. But I also feel that there would be, if we started to provide a narrative back to civil servants and politicians, which was more about people and human outcomes, that I always believe patient stories and family stories carry much more weight than spreadsheets and bar graphs. Mm-hmm.
But is that even just on a sort of, this is a concept that has been very well grasped in marketing, where they understand, you know, when you see an advert that is raising money for ActionAid or Oxfam or UNICEF or whatever, what is the opening shot in that advert? It is always a very small child crying. And then they tell you that personal story of that one child. They never, ever, I mean, UNICEF deal with millions of children around the world, tens of millions of people, of children around the world. They never open their adverts and say, UNICEF is trying to help 10 million children in Sudan. And statistically, you know, they never go with statistics. They never, ever go with that. They always go, this little baby boy who you can see crying needs help. And that's the, you know, because that's how humanity works. And so when we hear those stories of individual people, then we respond to the humanity in them. And perhaps that's one of the reasons that people dehumanize it and make it all about we've got to make tough fiscal decisions, is because once you just make it about a purely financial issue and you remove the humanity from the story, you don't have to give a shit that what you're doing is about to wreck the lives of millions of people. Just thought I would lighten the mood there.
I feel really light. I think I'll float to bed now.
Yeah.
So who do you think will be Prime Minister when we do our next pod?
I think Mr. Blobby is due a turn, surely.
Chances of a general election?
I think the chances of a general election are pretty low, actually. I think Rishi Sunak is going to tough it out over the next 2 years. He's going to keep saying, I'm running on the 2019 manifesto, which gave us a commanding majority, and he's just going to keep trotting out that line and saying, I'm sticking to the 2019 manifesto, even though he's clearly not. This week, it appears they're about to drop the policy of getting 6,000 new GPs. Stephen Barclay, the new health secretary, who was also the old health secretary. But yeah, the promise for 6,000 new GPs, that promise is just been quietly dropped, and nobody's calling them out on it.
Where would they find 6,000 new GPs then?
They would probably draw them out of the hospitals. And just make, well, you know, they've got a magic GP tree.
Is that in the same magic forest as the 40,000 nurses?
Yes, that's correct.
How's that working out for them?
Well, 40,000 nurses left the profession this year, in the last year. So
we've got an 80,000.
Yes.
They're not good at maths. I don't.
They're really not.
I don't think they would pass the drug calculation classes.
I don't think they would pass basic mathematics, to be honest. But anyway, listen. We're a long way into this episode, and we haven't even spoken about industrial action yet. The RCN completed its ballot, and yeah.
Yep, I can't say I was surprised, but I was surprised because I don't think, you know, I've watched many people on social media outlets talking about casting their vote. So I wasn't surprised that people vote, that, you know, the number of people that voted. I was quite disappointed in some of the areas that didn't get the ballots back, to be honest.
I can't engage in strike action because not enough people voted in my trust. I think we were about 45 votes short. Was it Southport, I believe? There was a trust in Southport that missed out on industrial action by a single vote. If one more person had returned a ballot in favour, then it would have been industrial action would have been permitted.
That's tough. That's tough to take. I think I have to commend the gusto with which they went after the votes to make sure that they had the mandate. Obviously, Scotland managed to get to a position of 100% of the territorial boards and branches had the mandate there to go with it. I think what we need to do is... Oh, sorry. Ed just put a message up for me. Stop blowing him kisses. I think what we had...
There's a good bit to edit out of the show.
Yeah, but you and your rant. So I'm really quite optimistic that a clear message has been sent, and I don't think it could be any clearer, you know, from a profession who, in their, regardless of whether it's the Royal College of Nursing or not, you know, nursing is not a profession who have readily walked away from providing their labour. And of course, nurses aren't just going to walk away and leave patients at risk. It will be clearly articulated with employers, and there will be plans and safety actions put in place. And I know that the RCN have went to extremely lengths to iterate what happened in Northern Ireland and how they worked with employers. So I have confidence that there will be patient safety at the heart of what we're doing. But let's not forget, part of the reason that we voted for, well, we were asked to vote on industrial action was about patient safety and safe staffing levels. It is important that we don't just talk about nurses' pay. It's not just about nurses' pay. It's about the future of the NHS and safe staffing and the quality of care. And I am sorry that some colleagues aren't, you know, the thresholds weren't met, but please do know that for any of us involved, that, you know, we carry the weight of everyone's expectations with us.
Absolutely. And if I can get a day off on Industrial Action Day, then I'll be going out and supporting my colleagues on whatever picket line I can find.
Yep. And hopefully we'll be able to, you know, there'll be plenty of information about what people should do and shouldn't do and how to engage safely and how to engage legally, because there's many loopholes there. And what we don't want is people getting themselves into bother. I mean, I don't speak for any trade union here. I'm just speaking as a colleague.
No. I guess I have a slight concern in that the delightful Priti Patel's new policing act, where protesting that causes a nuisance can get you arrested. And yeah, I wonder how that's going to work out with formally called industrial action. Can you be on a picket line and be causing a nuisance in a protest? Does that count?
It feels to me like there's someone at the 1920 whatever it is club constantly workshopping ideas and before anybody edits them.
Yeah.
They just appear as policy. And it's no wonder that the opposition benches are constantly scratching their heads with, what are we voting on now? What? Who? Where? You know, they seem to appear to pull policy and legislation out of thin air based upon the problem of the week. It looks like there could be some strikes. Quick, get some policy out that might hamper it.
I mean, it really is bizarre. I mean, it's so regressive. It's so backward looking. And if you were in a school and your teacher was turning up drunk and you went to the headmaster and said, I'm quite worried that our teacher is turning up drunk, and then the headmaster expelled you. That's the level that we're at. You know, it's just this, the world is falling apart. You people are corrupt to the core, and you have no qualifications and no decency, and you are consistent liars, and you're racists, and you're governed by foreign money, and you're sitting on a report on foreign interference, and we know that you've been, you know, giving away defense secrets to foreign nationals, and you're not paying us properly, and our terms and conditions are absolutely appalling. What have you got to say for yourselves? And their response is, we're going to make it illegal for you to say that to me, because you've just upset me and I'm offended, and now what you've done is against the law. And it's just like,
so just to be arbitrary and clear,
you should feel bloody lucky that I allow you to live.
So just that's to be clear here, all of those things that you just alleged that certain people were was part of a narrative and satirical retort.
Right. Yeah, except that we do know that Priti Patel held meetings with foreign defense officials without. Yeah,
we do. I think the thing is, though, none of it surprises anybody anymore. There's this horrible fatalistic view of it all.
Yeah, which leads us into the really false narrative of politicians, they're all the same. No, they're not. There are actually some who don't tell lies and don't give away state secrets to foreign governments, but they seem not to be in charge.
I'm enjoying being on the righteous side tonight, Ed. I put it to you like this. We started off talking about the regulation of MPs, and if we keep doing the same thing and expect our elected representatives to do what we think is right without giving them proper guidance, without giving them appropriate education and training, and giving them, I believe that there are some genuinely good people with good values there. But once you go into that hodgepodge of whether it doesn't matter what political arena it's in, party politics supersedes a lot of those individualized values. And I think without actually having that objective oversight that a regulator brings and that professionalism that a regulator brings, how can we expect people to know the rules when we don't give them any rules other than a parliamentary code, which appears to be as ambiguous as IKEA flat pack instructions? Do you know, make of this picture what you will, you need a hammer, a screwdriver, and some and two
a friend.
You know, make of it what you will. And I think this is the problem as well. You know, if you do a root cause analysis on this, just don't be a criminal and hold a UK passport. You know, and even that's judgmental, because who's to say that someone who hasn't served and spent their conviction doesn't have something to offer? When you think about some of the things that people in authority are not prosecuted for, and I'm thinking about things like, you know, breach of COVID regulations.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was okay because Matt Hancock fell in love.
How's Matt doing? What's he up to?
Ah, well, apparently he ate a camel's penis the other day, but I'm really trying not to watch him in the jungle.
I don't even want it. It's just so crass that even the production company of that show chose to put him in there.
Paid £400,000 for appearing on that, while, incidentally, he should be at work.
We have policies about stuff like that, don't we?
Well, if I didn't turn up at my shifts because I was appearing on a TV programme, you know, if I just failed to turn up and do my job, I would be sacked.
Is that you looking for parity again?
I mean, I wouldn't mind the £400,000. I don't fancy eating camel penis, thank you very much.
And think of a nicer person to do it.
Me or him?
You can leave that with the listeners.
Well, that seems like a good place to draw this to a close.
You know, I don't often leave these conversations feeling pretty despondent, but I am tonight. God knows how people perceive that.
I mean, you know, I think we've actually tracked a completely obvious and natural line from the Tories to a camel's willy. And I think that's the natural endpoint of that narrative. Thank you for listening. Enduring this episode of RMN Behaving Badly. Genuinely, we've got such gratitude for those of you who make it to the end of the podcast. I mean, it's hard enough for us. Music for the episode is by the Barstool Astronaut. You can find his music at barstoolastronaut.com and on Spotify. Please have a listen, buy something, and let him know that we sent you. Our special thanks go to our patrons, whose patience is matched only by their money. I mean, discerning taste and commitment to nursing advocacy. Yeah, that'll do. You can join them by visiting patreon.com/RMNbehavingbadly. We're on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, mostly at RMNBB Podcast. Stuart is at Stuart McKenzie and I'm at Ed Freshwater. If you feel improperly clothed while listening to this podcast, head to our website at rmnbehavingbadly.co.uk, where you can find links to t-shirts and tote bags and tea mugs. While you're there, you can find all of our previous episodes, show notes, and our blog. If you're new to the show, my goodness, what's happened to your life? Please be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, Anchor, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, Belafonte, Stitcher, and all the other places what does the hosting. Hey, Stuart, I made up one of those. Can you guess which one? Oh, he's gone to sleep. That's probably a... Yes! Well done. That's probably a good sign to shut up now. Once again, thanks for listening. And until next time, stay safe, stay well. Speak to you soon. And damn with the Tories.